certain, like, people not wanting certain books.
Yeah, well, we're getting in on it. We're getting in on it. Don't you worry. All right. We begin. Tonight is the 29th class of the Senior Fellowship.
Wow.
Yeah, you guys doing good. We're going to start off with a video, as we like to do. All right, guys. T-Luck, you should hit the lights.
Yeah.
After this, the topic is, do all 18-year-olds have an obligation to enlist in the Israeli army? Here we go.
Oh, Operation Protective Edge.
There we go. Okay. Then after that, I don't want to go into great life. Life police. Yeah, good. All right. So, how scary is it to go house to house in Gaza, which is viewed as the most densely populated Gaza City, on Earth? How scary is this?
You
have to watch. And this is not even the most intense. I didn't go for the most gruesome one. So in fact, when the fellows went during Protective Edge, So did you guys? You went to the hospital, right? You guys visited or visited?
We did. We went to the hospital.
How? From the war. So what? Who did you? What kind of guys were? What kind of condition were they?
They had very high morale, but they were. I have them pictured in my head, but I don't remember exactly.
So I went to visit my parents after that, and my first cousin, so he's my age, 50 and 51, and his son was wounded. He lost his a number of his digits, including his thumb. So that's like, you know, and his arm and his leg, because I don't know, an RPG blew up in relatively close proximity. So I went there, bought the guitar, and they did a thing where they take your like middle finger and they put it to make it into your thumb so you can be able to grasp things. All right, so it's very intense. So the being in the Israeli army, while it's kind of cool, it's very dangerous. I don't think we don't have to go to that. I'm going to this guy, just one quick. Now, these are three kids of friends of mine. This is the Stufflebean family from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Okay, so the Stufflebean, now they have a fourth son who's now made Aliyah, who joined as a lone soldier. We've had lone shoulder events, okay? So these are brothers Eitan, Adam, and Jared, which in Israel becomes Jared. All right, Jared. And it's the third son. Three of them made Sayeret, which is a special forces. Now, in order to do special forces, you're in there, you have to commit to, first of all, you have to be able to make it in. You're committing to 18 months of training to learn a series of special skills, okay? And then you have to stay longer in the Israeli army. So they all did this, all right? And why this is a whole story, but just you got the view. There's two dudes. Some are at, or two are at already. Okay, so that's it. We're not going through that. That's all you need to know. All right, so how old are these kids? I mean, how old are these young people? They're kids in my mind. That's it. The commander, how old is the commander going to be of a typical platoon? No, he'll be an ancient 22 or 23. He's a commander. When we went last time to Hebron, like these guys' beards are not fully grown in. The guns are bigger, you know, these massive guns. Who went with me on the army base, right? Give out the stuff? You were there. You were not there that year. It was the next year. Went to the Hebron army base.
You couldn't go.
No, they were not living. It was not going to be a visitation. So, now, here's the question. Now, when Mrs. Stufflebean, who's living in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, has two of her boys, not just in infantry, but in special forces, what were the special forces doing during the Gaza War?
Tunnels.
So they have to go into the tunnels. Now, destroy the tunnels, go in there, go behind enemy lines. They have stuff. They're going into. Hey, Jen, how are you? Welcome.
Good.
Thank you. All right, let me just share screen. So how do you think she was dealing when they had took a time during those 2 weeks? Take a guess. How did she feel during the? She was deafened. She could not sleep. She simply could not sleep because she. What is she afraid of? Getting a call. Well, getting a call that her son is severely injured or worse. That was basically, so for the entire duration, I don't know, many days, I don't know, 25 days, whatever one it was, I don't remember the exact amount. That's it. So that's the deal. All right, so let's have somebody read the psukim here. Okay, who volunteers? All right, Tila.
The petition?
Yeah, petition.
Had an extremely large number of animals, and they saw that Yazer and the Gilead areas were good for livestock. The descendants of Gad and Reuben, therefore, came and presented the following petition to Eliezer, the priest, and the Pleiade princess, Atorot, Devon, Yazer, Nima, Iman, Nebo, and Beon, in the land that God struck down before the Israelite community is livestock land, and what we have is livestock.
All right, stop right here. So let me give you the setting. This is taking place at the end of the book of Bamidbar. The Jews have already been in their travels for 40 years. They've already gone on in Jordan, actually in the Golan Heights. They've done a number of successful wars, and in the Golan Heights and in that part of Jordan, apparently at that time, what did they have? Lots of. What was it? The Jordan River family was much more larger, and therefore irrigated the entire area, and therefore what did they have? Well, they had a lot of livestock. Fertile ground where they can actually provide. They can raise their cattle. Let's go on to verse 5.
Okay, Moses said to the petition. They said, "If you grant us a favor, then let this land be given to us as our permanent property, and do not bring us across Jordan." Moses said to the descendants of God and Reuben, "Is it right that your brothers go out and fight while you stay there? Will you stay here?"
Right, so they said, "We want to stay here. We'll stay here, guys, and you guys go into the land and fight all the 31 Canaanite kings. And we'll set up here and set up our large cattle ranches." And so Moshe said, "Is it right that your brothers go out and fight while you stay here?" That's a rhetorical question. I was saying, it is not right that you so this tension about who has to fight has existed since the infancy of the Jewish people. From day one, there was already a part of the population that wanted other people to do the dirty work, and while they were sitting pretty, building their business. Okay, now I'm gonna go skip to question number 5. Compare and contrast Reuben and God and the feelings of most American Jews. This might be a little bit uncomfortable for all of us, but we're, you know, it will be good.
Personally say, because I actually have gotten discharged from the Israeli army. I have my now my mom's Israeli, so I had to get discharged papers. And I remember going to get it, and I was like 18 or something. I went to the consulate with her.
Okay.
And you have to really fight them to prove that no, I live here. I had my college. Like I go to college here. This is my permanent address. It was a big deal. And it was definitely like an intense, like they were really like, why are you wearing a unit?
Right. Right. They were not viewing it as, oh, I'm living here and therefore you're good. Right. They're viewing it as why they were having the attitude, is it right that your brother go out and fight and you stay here? Mm-hmm. They literally said the verse to you. That's awesome.
Yeah, they would not let me defend.
Yes, if she would have not done that and gone, then she's a draft dodger. And then she could be in prison.
Mm-hmm. But only during that
certain age. No. I know a guy.
I mean, they're not gonna take me now, but
I have my again?
How long have you
been? No, once you're in the system, I'm saying, but if you don't deal, let's say your family moved that to the United States when you were like 16. You just keep all doing this. And you just walk into Israel when you're like 20 years old, they can arrest you at Ben Gurion. You're a draft doctor.
If you want to get arrested in another country, you could be
in Israel. That's Israel, correct. Yeah. Okay. All right. Now, Biden, so you're different because you're not the feelings of most. How do most American Jews feel about, you know, how would you compare Reuben and God and the feelings of most American Jews as far as the obligation to protect the land of Israel and the Jewish people?
They can do it. We stay here.
No, it's exactly the same. We're good here. We're good. We're in America. We're comfortable. We're gonna have a latte later. And you guys, we'll watch what you guys do on CNN. And we'll write a check.
That's just for the people that are not being armchair critics.
What?
That's just for the people that are not being armchair critics. There's a lot of critics here that are American.
Right. And not only that, we're gonna sit here and not help you guys out, and then we're gonna criticize you guys.
Right.
Even better.
Right.
It's a bigger chutzpah. Okay. Right. Okay. Good. We're getting someplace. Okay, question number six. During the Holocaust, where were European Jews able to go to escape Nazi genocide? There's a simple answer. Basically nowhere. The answer is basically that's why they could not get out, and that's why they all died. Okay? Those who were able to get out, there were very few visas. I mean, of course, you have the St. Louis, the tragic story of the St. Louis, coming to America, not being accepted, going to Cuba, not being accepted, and going back to Germany, and basically all of them being killed. You had no choice. Nobody would accept them. No, this is history. This is the voyage of the St. Louis. Wikipedia after class. It's a terrible story. Okay. We're going to have a positive ending here, but we're going to have to go through this, okay? All right. We want to teach you about reality. This is it. Now, where do European Jews plan to go in the face of the rise of anti-Semitism now? Right. We'll go down to the next little box over here. Turn the page, top of the page, the second side. A May 2014 survey revealed that 74% of French Jews consider leaving France for Israel. Where are the 74%? 29% cite, nearly 30% cite anti-Semitism. And many have, when we go to Israel, there's certain, like Netanya. If you can speak French, you don't have to use a word of Hebrew. There are certain communities, neighborhoods in Israel, in Jerusalem, speak French. You see, there are French bakeries opening up. They want people to have the authentic French experience. Because basically, they're checking out. They're afraid. You cannot wear a kippah in Paris without being beaten up.
There's an article recently that all
right, the people they're checking out.
She was saying how scary it was.
Right, so let's go backing up. So therefore, basically, Israel is, what is Israel? No matter what you feel, Zionism, not Zionism, it is a place. Israel is a Jew's home, i.e. a place where they have to take you in. They will. What is the rule about if you go to Israel and you want to immigrate there if you're Jewish? What's the rule? And therefore, what does that mean?
It's the way of the term.
Which means what?
You have a home.
you're granted immediate citizenship. How do you come to America? You're granted immediate citizenship? Oh, no way. No, you can't. First of all, you just can't show up for your you can't. You can get a tourist visa for a short amount of time. Maybe you can get a work visa for a short time if you're working for a corporation. That's it. All right, let's keep on rocking and rolling here. And question number 8, where would we all go if Aunt, yes. You left. Well, I've signed many letters validating a person's Judaism. You have to write a formal letter from an Orthodox rabbi that you're claiming you're Jewish. I've done it for conservative reform Jews. But I know that, well, the person may be pertinent, or they're observant and undo their Judaism. Okay. In other words, I just say, I know that their mother is all Jew. The end.
Okay, so
I mostly write it for non-Orthodox Jews.
Okay, so
in other words, halachi Orthodox Jews, they're not asking to write them letters. It's for all non-Orthodox Jews.
And technically,
it's a tuba, right? But you can have all kinds of documents that they'll accept to prove your Jew. But if you are a Jew, you get automatic citizenship, and then a whole right and the rights of making aliyah. You get a lot of benefits. Okay, where would all of us go if anti-Semitism arose in the United States? Okay.
Israel.
Okay, just making a point over here. All right, so basically, we're the fair river. No, so basically, when we're in trouble, we want them to bail us out. But when they need help, we're nowhere to be found. Okay, just checking on that. Just keep on going here. All right, we're going to go a little revision to the Gemara here. Famous piece of the Talmud. Who would like to read? We're going to go to Samantha. 25b.
Old officials said to me, go kill so-and-so, and if not, I will kill you. Rabbi said to him, it's preferable that he can kill you and use the knife. What do you think that your vote is better than the person for this? That answer was like, apparently, it may not stay in his own life, but he can use
the knife. It's very interesting, halacha. If a person puts a gun to your head, and tragedy has happened many times in Jewish history, and tells you, you need to kill this person. If you do not kill this person, I will kill you. Luckily, you have to take the bullet. Why? What did Rava say? But what is it? That's a poetic saying. Blood being redder. What's the deeper message behind that statement? True. But if you can argue, this way. Look, it'll be a net result of one person, one Jew being killed. So if one Jew can be killed, let it be that guy. In other words, this guy is going to kill one person. It could be me, or I can kill that other person. What's the argument back? Say, no, we're going to definitely net result. The Jew people will be reduced by one person. Let it be that guy. Now, why can I say, my blood is not any red. Why is his blood any redder than mine? You know what I'm saying? In other words, my question is, in other words, I'm going to make the counter argument to you guys. I'm going to challenge you guys and say, okay. You're not killing this person. That's not the right word. You are
murder.
Thank you. What's the difference between killing and murdering, just quickly?
Murder is taking an innocent life.
You're right. He's taking innocent blood, killing somebody without. Murder is the unlawful killing of someone. Killing is just ending somebody's life. It could be in a war. It could be right. It's a neutrality. In other words, that's why when the Torah says "lo tirsach," to translate "thou shalt not kill" is wrong. It's "thou shalt not murder." There are circumstances where you can kill. When you're shooting guns, you're killing people. That's justified. It's not murder. It's killing. You're defending yourself. Okay? Dan, please fill out your idea.
Well, I'm not sure if you can fill that out. Aside from you're taking the decision to
life. Yeah, but the net result is, but if I don't kill this guy, I'm going to get killed.
Then the person who kills you is not them.
Okay.
They're murdering.
But you have no right to murder somebody.
That's right.
That presupposes something, a deeper idea. Or the idea of the blood not being red is that it means that we don't have the right to step into the shoes of God and make a judgment about who has any existential value. That this person is more valuable than us. That is, by definition, beyond human comprehension. That's not our business, and we can't do that. And the truth is, if a person has a tragic situation, you got to take the bullet. Here's a tragic halachic question. Ready for this? We're taking down a couple notches, Samantha. You know, we're going to move it back up. Don't worry about it. All right. But I'll give you halacha l'maisa, tragic, you know, just brace yourself. The Nazis in the concentration camp were liquidating whether it was the Kovno ghetto or the concentration camp. And they wanted the capos, which were the Jewish administrators of the people who worked for the Nazis, to gather 300 children. Follow me on this one. This person, so the Nazi guard doesn't care if it's any particular person. He's got to collect 300 people. He would accept a diamond ring to take out and put another kid in. Are you allowed to bribe the Nazi guard with your kid? The kid's going to be killed. Gassed and burnt. You have the diamond ring. What do you say?
Yeah, you can do it.
Why?
No child, your child's life is so much more precious. Your child's life is so much more precious to you than some other child, even though they're all precious.
But one second. What did we just read on? Let's go back to the Talmud and stop him. What does a man think? That your blood is redder and more precious? Perhaps this man's blood is redder. No, he's being, perhaps, I'm saying perhaps. I mean, you have no right to make a judgment that anybody has, is one kid is better, you're better than anybody else. You have no right to be in the judging whose life is more valuable business.
No, it's not.
Okay, so you're saying that they might practically do that.
So there is a difference in that you're not doing the killing this time around.
You have to do everything you have to present yourself, you're paying the Nazi to kill another kid than your own kid.
Yeah,
I could. Well,
but isn't that there's no.
No, 100%. This is your 100% thing. They're going to be gone. This is. I think it was in. It was one of the concentration camps. One thing is. So the Rabbi Oshri, who was the halachic, he said to the person, he says, "Look, I don't have any of the books there." The answer, in other words, is like, I can't, I have nothing to say. But he said fundamentally, but the person understood that the basic halacha is you can't do it. And to work out some halachic loophole, some creative, I got nothing. And the guy did not bribe the person. So that is some serious tragedy, actually. Okay, but that's also a person who really is not viewing this as being a nice little text, but being a governing principle that I have no right to actively murder another child because I love my child. And while that parent doesn't love their child, of course they love that child. You can't do that. So that was actually a case that happened, tragically. All right, moving it back. Now we went to the low point. Now we're going to move back up. Okay, we're going to go to the Rambam, Loss of Kings and Their Wars. All right, Jade, read it out.
Or
Milchemeth means a war of mitzvah or a war of duty bound mitzvah. You must fight. Go on.
What is considered as Milchemeth?
Okay, stop right there. The last thing, a war, if you had in order to dispossess the seven kings who were in Israel, the war against Amalek, and a war fought to assist Israel from an enemy which attacks them. So the war in Gaza, what category would you put that in? And the opposite of Milchemet Mitzvah is Milchemet Rishut, an optional war. What do you say? Milchemet Mitzvah? No, just the guys bring you up. They were raining down rockets into Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. FYI, just in case you forgot for a second. Milchemet Mitzvah or Milchemet Rishut? Yeah, it's an obligatory war. Now, the king, we don't have a king, so the totality of the Jewish people, their legal, their north, the Rosh HaMemshalah, the prime minister and his cabinet, is de facto in lieu of a Jewish king. They have the halachic status of being in charge of the well-being of the Jewish people, okay? Until there is a Jewish sovereignty. Go on.
Afterwards, the main wage of war,
Mohammed
Harishut. A work for other
nations. So there is an idea of expanding territory. It's interesting, Mohammed Rishut. But it can only be done when all the obligatory wars are taken care of. King David expanded the borders, did some Mohammed Rishut. That's a whole interesting thing. We'll have, there could be an optional war. Okay, that's a whole interesting, juicy topic. We're not touching it today. I want to focus on the Milchemet Mitzvah. Go ahead.
Chapter 7.
We're skipping 2 chapters.
Then
Mishuach Mohammed. All right, so Mishuach Mohammed, let me explain what that is. And they actually still do this to this very day. Mishuach Mohammed is the anointed Kohen who goes out to the troops before they're going to do an invasion. And he tells them inspirational words. But before he does that, he announced who is exempt. And this is the exemption we mentioned. In order, you always, from the Torah, you had those who are exempt from military. Let's go on. Let's read the list.
Is there a man who has built a new house? Let him go home.
One.
Is there a man who has planted a vineyard? Let him go home. Is there a man who has consecrated a woman?
No, he got engaged.
Let him go home. No. These words are related by the Mishuach Mokama. Afterwards, an officer proclaims his words to the nation and the loud voice. The officer announces on his own mission. Is there a man who is afraid or faint-hearted? Let him go home. Another officer proclaims his words to the people, in which instances are the above mentioned individuals sent away from battle.
Right. So let me start there. So therefore, in a optional war, there are these 5 exemptions: new house, vineyard, getting married, and you're petrified, you're afraid. You can walk away from the front. Okay. Now, that's what this applies in a Milchemet Rishut. By in contrast, in the Milchemet Mitzvah, read this out.
Where was I? Another officer proclaims these words to the people, in which the instances are the above mentioned individuals sent away from battle. The Milchemet Rishut, by contrast, in the Milchemet Mitzvah, the entire nation should go out to war, even in room from his chamber and bride from the village.
Okay, notice the language there in the Rambam. When there's a Milchemet Mitzvah, who has to go? What's the line? The entire nation, not just the people who are local, the entire nation. And who has to go? Even the, what is the groom, what does it mean by groom from his chamber? What chamber are they talking about? Right, the chuppah. Right, in order to have the yichud room, or basically saying that even at the middle of his wedding party, he's got to go to the, he's got to hit one round, and who, even the bride. Now, the commentary say not that she has to fight war, but there's all the ancillary support work. There could be running a medical, and nowadays you'll have intelligence and the supply line, and training. There's so much they can do. They don't have to fight a lot. A woman, by the way, it's this very day. If you're in the army, if you don't want to do combat, you don't have to do combat if you're a woman. Okay. Now, so here now, so I stacked the decks very harshly against all of us, myself included, okay? Now, so what is our heter? Heter means what is our halachic dispensation for non-enlisting? Even that, I don't know, not everybody's building a house. And
that's the only way.
Right. So anybody else want to render a guess? Why are we not obligated to be in the army when we're 18 halachically and send our kids, even from America, like the Stuffle Beans?
Because
What?
They don't listen, bro.
No, but it just says the whole nation. If you have to interrupt a wedding to get to the front line, a wedding, that's rather invasive. Rather invasive.
Wedding in Israel versus wedding here.
Doesn't say.
There is no.
So the heter is like this. You know, I'm not going to give you guys anything. The heter is like this. That the Israeli government, which is they have a right to say who we're organizing the war, who we're going to draft. And we elect, either for practical reasons or for our needs, to draft the people who actually be living in the state of Israel. If they would announce an international draft, logically, everybody have to go.
Would they ever do that?
If it got really, really bad. Now, you should know, in 1967, 1973, many people went, when things were going down, many Americans went. I was actually at a Shabbos table on the east side of this Shabbos with a guy who's a physician. And he was just in Israel right before the 73 war. He's an orthopedic surgeon. He was a resident at the time. And the war broke out. And I don't know about you, but if you guys know about it, but the 73 war, the first 10 days were horrible. They lost 3,000 men. Now in Israel, back then there was like 2.5 million Jews. So that was basically everybody's one degree around, one someone who knew, you basically the entire degree, you knew somebody who was killed. It was bad. He went to the Haifa hospital, and he was basically, so they were from the Syrian front. He was getting all, you know, he was the surgeon, even though he's a resident, he wasn't even fully baked. And people were saying, you know, you got to come back to New York Presbyterian. We need you over here. I need a little time. He stayed there during the duration of the war as a volunteer because it was like a terrible situation. It lasted a month. But in the first thing, it was nearly, if they would have, they nearly lost.
Don Howard, right behind DRS.
Nearly lost.
Howard Street. It's right.
Okay, so that's the heter. The heter is, they're not asking us. That's the heter, that they have a right to, this is what our needs are for the army, and we're going to ask those 18-year-olds, and also they have all things. We can say people have a certain level of fitness, and if you have a certain medical thing. And also, they also allow, if you're in learning in yeshiva, you have a dispensational learning, which, of course, is a big topic of contention. That's why they have, you can go into different programs. You can go into Hesder. You have all kinds of things. But fundamentally, if you're in Israel, you really can't just halachically blow it off. Okay? Now, the main point of this thing is that now, once now I got you off the hook, I'm not getting you fully off the hook. Okay? I'm not getting you fully off. Or the reality is like this. This is the last line. The entire nation must go out to war. Brings out the main concept I want to share you with tonight. Is that we're very used to being individual Jews. We get up in the morning, I daven, I eat kosher, keep Shabbat. I do that fundamentally as an individual. Now, but I have a whole host of communal responsibility and national responsibility. So I want to ask you guys, what are things that we do obligatory as a communal Jew, or even a national Jew, and what are things that we can do? Yeah, Jay. Go ahead, ask me anything.
And how are the Haredi community? They're basically in breach of it.
Okay, so that's a juicy topic. That could literally be a class,
but
I'm going to give you a relatively short answer. So here, let me take you back to 1948. Who was the prime minister? Nope. Ben Gurion, the first prime minister of Israel. At that point, the leader of the Haredim, the ultra-Orthodox, was a man named the Chazon Ish. Okay, famous in Bnei Brak. Famous. He was the leader of the non-Hasidic Haredim. There are two categories of ultra-Orthodox. You have your Hasidic variety, and you have your, you know, yeshivish or non-Hasidic Lithuanian variety. He represented the Lithuanian variety. Okay? You can tell in difference of dress. In other words, the Hasidim always have long peyos. They wear different kinds of hats. They might wear a rekel, bekesha, different kind of Hasidic garb. Okay. Anyways, he made the following deal. And it was basically, Now, Ben-Gurion wanted to create a harmonious society. He had a number of tribes. He had a super secular Zionist. He had traditionalists. And he had the Haredim. And they're holding on by a string. So he cut a deal. We're going to make, or he made it the deal, the famous status quo. You guys will be in control of marriage, divorce, conversion, national kashrut. There'll be some semblance of a Shabbat in certain places. We'll negotiate some of the things. Okay? And it's called the status quo. Still basically in force. It's always a source of tension. In one of my first Israel trips with the fellows, going back to the summer of 2008, we saw a band of Haredim from Mea Sharm come out to throw stones at cars that are driving in Jerusalem. They felt that they're violating. This is a Shabbos town, and you're killing my Shabbos while you're driving around. Okay? So it's not exactly working perfectly. All right. The next deal was the deal about the army. At that time, there were 400 men learning full-time in yeshiva. He says, anybody who's learning full-time, they go on an exemption from the Israeli army because they're helping the Jewish people spiritually. 400 men. Okay? So basically, Ben-Gurion said, sweet deal. You got it. 400 men's nothing. What was he thinking? He said to his, one of his associates says, well, why'd you do this? I just says, guys, these people, they're the last of the Mohicans. There won't be Haredim 10 years from now. There won't be Haredim. There will not be Haredim 10 years from now. They're going to become Israelis. They're going to give up. They're stuck to their old ways, but they're going to, there won't be an Orthodox in Israel. There'll be Israelis. We don't have to worry about it. We'll get the deal now, have some Shalom Bias in the house, and we're going to be good. Okay, now, fast forward to 2018. Okay, there's a million Haredim. They're set out of the 7 million Jews, and basically in 2025 there'll be a full 25% of the Jews in Israel. There are 48,000 people from 400 to 48,000 people using that exemption. There was this. It was basically people commissioned. This is basically unjust. As they quote the verse. It's in the paper all the time in Hebrew. Our brothers should go out. Your brother should go out and fight, and we should stay back. So it's in the papers all the time. So there was a whole Supreme Court, and then they remanded to the Knesset to work out a deal. And then basically, since the politics is that Netanyahu will stay in power, and he needs a Haredi to stay in power. He needs 61 votes. He's cutting deals to delay, but it's not happening. But meanwhile, now there's a second factor which is also very powerful. If you don't go to the army in Israel, you cannot go to you cannot work. You cannot go to college until you get official sign off from things. So if you went to the thing, you have to do some service at the end. Or it's not an exemption, it's not an internal exemption. So Haredim basically forcing a lot of the Haredim to go into the black market, work off the books. Because they could not legally work. A lot of people can't. First of all, very few people can really learn all day long. Right? How do you feel after from learning from 7 to 10:15 at the fellowship? At 10:15, how do you feel? Wow, I'm pretty much done. We're good. We're done. So imagine all day long. So it's not the nature of the Jewish people to have that percentage of people who can do that. So, but their community doesn't want them to go in the Israeli army for other reasons. What are the reasons?
They don't believe.
Well, first of all, some people because of the state. Other people is it because they're worried that they're going to go in the Israeli army. They're going to acculturate because the army is an acculturation. So they created a Nachal Haredi, separate all men platoons where they're Haredi, and many people are joining them because they don't want to be live in poverty. Not going to the army, Israeli army basically is the gateway to poverty. You can't get higher education, can't get a good job. Can't make money and can't support your family. So that's a whole topic. And you go, there's a lot of material on that. Then you have the middle, they have the religious Zionists, they have just the opposite. These guys are religious Zionists, they're not only just that community, they're like a high percentage of commanders are from the Dati Lumi, the religious Zionists.
What's the religious
Zionist
view of co-ed
Look, you don't want to be naive that that's not an ideal situation. That's why I love it. Well, I really want to go to a HESDER program when you're learning. Mm-hmm. The five-year program, you're learning, and then and you'll be all with your guys. So okay. It's better. It's not good because, let me put it away, there's a law in the, this is another shocker here, there's a law in the Israeli army that they will pay for up to 4 abortions.
Wait, what?
Whoa.
Wow.
Now, why is that law? 4.
Apparently, a lot of people are getting pregnant.
Yes. Yeah, if you're not, I mean, again, it's wow. Not, you have 18 to 20-year-old guys. It's like a fraternity and sorority with not a lot of schmear going, a lot of rabbis watching. If you're secular, why not?
Using abortion
as birth. No, I'm not saying none of them want to get an abortion. I'm not saying like they don't want to get pregnant. I'm just saying it happens. I'm just saying there's a lot of it's a promiscuous situation. That's what I'm trying to say. I'm using it in a more of extreme. Okay. All right, now let's get a take. We only got 7 minutes left. Okay, that's why you're in a co-ed thing. I mean, what you're training people? Come on, and you're 19 years old. Go back to when you were 19 years old.
Look at me.
I'm not looking up all you guys. You can look at me. 19-year-old guys and girls. Come on.
Yeah.
Okay, that's you know, what do you think's going on there? I mean, they got to, you know, whatever. They're doing a job, but whatever. Let's move on. You got the idea. Okay, what are 3 things we do to be active in communal Jew? That makes you guys all fully uncomfortable? We can move on. All right. Right, there you go. Now, all right, so but not a thing like this. So first of all, I think we should, by the way, I would like to write them a note, these 4 boys. We should write all these guys notes to thank them for their service. So we should all commit to do that. I'm going to send you the information. We'll send them out a note because these guys are actually, the mother knows, like his cell phone is off for 2 weeks at a time. You know that your kid's on cell phone at 2 week time? Because, you know, like they bombed various installations in Syria where they're Iran is building. Now, some of that intel they can get from satellite, and some of that intel they can get from drones, but they can't get all of it. You know what they do? They send people in who are adept at basically being, you know, you sit with camouflage, be able to sit on the side of a mountain without moving for 2 days. We hosted, were you here? A Peace of Mind, where we had the Agozi commanders. They were part of the Lebanon War II from 10 years ago, and they were in the first 5 minutes of the war. Remember that? They were here for I was at a Friday night dinner. They spoke. Basically, they were on the ridge. They had not good information, and that Hezbollah had. Syria had Russian advanced anti-tank missiles. So they're there. Missiles were detonated, and they saw, these are elite guys, they saw 5 guys literally get blown up to pieces in front of them. Like, you know, their stuff stuck. Your friend is stuck physically to you, all right? So it's brutal. So they don't have, these guys suffered, you know, post-traumatic stress syndrome. So they don't really have. So this organization called Peace of Mind deal, take them to America. This is 10 years later. They don't talk because they're tough guys. They're like Green Beret guys. So these guys are doing very dangerous stuff. So they have a therapist, and they take these guys out. And part of, they came to us. They were here.
Yes.
Morning,
yes.
So. Yeah. Yes. Okay. That was those guys. That was that group. Oh. So they were there. They saw brutal stuff because they were part of a Gozi battalion. Is the battalion that's doing the most. Is there first. All right. Anyways, moving back. So what else can we do to be active? In other words, it's very important. The key message like this. Yes, you're an individual Jew. You're learning. And you're learning with the chavrusa. So you join a minyan. You dive in with the community. You help out the community. But it's very important to view that, you know, these guys, they got a schwitz, and we could lay back. So give me some things that we can do to be to care about, get a sense of being a communal Jew. Give me ideas. Let's flash down some ideas. The one thing about the senior fellowship, I haven't nudged you about it, but to do a, first of all, to invite people to a Shal Shudas, invite people in your apartment, have a Shal Shudas, invite people who would not have a Shabbos experience. That's an easy layup. Include people that never had a taste of Shabbos. That's a very relatively easy thing to do. What else? Do some other stuff.
That we can do for what? Because we're not.
I'm just saying that in order, it's very important in America. It's very easy to get it to be an individual Jew and not have your national Jewish element develop. When we go to Israel, you land there, you feel you're part of the national. You're part of the national conversation.
I just
found a TV show. Right, found it on Netflix. By the way, they just launched their second season. By the way. Right. Brutal. By the way, that's not you know.
Oh my gosh, will I get
PTSD from? Yeah, don't watch that. Not for you. Not for you.
I need to watch it.
No, it's not for you. Really, it's brutal.
Make donations.
Make donations. Yes. It's not just not no.
But the community. Also just being educated about what's going on in Israel. Yes, but. Taught, like, you know,
educated
through.
Yeah, that's what
I'm saying. You're saying the community here too, right?
The community here also.
Bigger colon.
What else? Inviting people, join the community, but learning, but not just for yourself. The key thing is to go beyond yourself.
A
formal learning group. And look, we to participate in the Lone Soldier Project. We've done all these projects we do at MG. It basically is to foster that sense that you can't say I'm living here in New York. Let them do the schlepping. Let them set up the Israel Disney so when we go there, we can now enjoy. So we can have cool, attractive guys to take pictures with. All right. Bring in the extras, Israeli soldier extra guys. Hashtag, right? So that's what they're there for. So therefore, we can have our little Disney visit of Israel, and then we can go home. Is that what that's not really, that's not being a national group. That's using them to make us feel good about ourselves.
Going on the Israel trip in 2014 and going to the Kunitera Crossing, and we were at Cafe Amman, and drinking our Israeli version frappuccinos overlooking Syria and hearing gunshots. I mean, that's very surreal.
Right, that is surreal. So I just, the key point is like this. Our natural default setting is to be a personal Jew. What do we know? I'm doing this learning. I'm keeping the Shabbos. I'm doing that. You got to start fostering the idea of going to a minyan. Is strengthening ours, allowing other people to do to be able to have a Torah reading, to be able to say Kedusha, to be able to have a much more robust experience. Inviting others who've not done that, learning with other people beyond yourself, support Israel stuff, bring out Israeli awareness. There's a thousand opportunities. You just have to find the one that resonates with you. Go and work at there's many Jewish soup kitchens available. There's masiba. There's all over the New York area. There's so many things to do to start to develop your empathy and your sense of solidarity with the Jews beyond your circle. And that's something that's a critical part of being a mature Jew. That's really, you're a happening Jew when you're starting to think communally. And that's something, and there's no lack of opportunity. You have to find your portal to get in. But that's a very important thing to know that. And whether it's we all can't join the Green Berets of Israel. We're all too old. They sent us an email. By the way, can we join the Israelis? They don't want us. Okay. No. We've aged out. But my point is, there's a thousand ways to be a communal Jew and a national Jew. And it's very important to be a Jew is to think in those kind of terms. What I want to show you tonight. All right, guys. Have a great night.
Thank you.
Bye, Lato. Bye.
Oh, my God.
Bye, Charles. Bye, Jenna. Have a good night. You're well.
Thank you.